From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, how black South African reporters cover apartheid. White American journalist William Finnegan spent 6 weeks traveling with black South African reporters, and he's written a book describing why journalism is such a dangerous business in South Africa. In the late 60s and early 70s, David Crosby was famous for the harmonies he sang with the Byrds and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. But soon he was infamous as a paranoid, dissipated drug addict. He went through cold turkey while in solitary confinement on drug charges. Now he's back in the recording studio. Coming up, the first of a two-part interview with David Crosby. And rock and roll historian Ed Ward concludes his two-part profile of his favorite 50s group, the Five Royales. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. William Finnegan has covered South Africa from a perspective usually closed off to white American journalists. He traveled through black townships with black South African reporters during 6 weeks of the summer of 1986. Just a few days after he arrived in South Africa, the government declared a state of emergency. It effectively restricted the press coverage of unrest to items released by the Bureau of Information in Pretoria. The black reporters Finnegan traveled with worked for the white liberal paper The Johannesburg Star. The position of the reporters struck Finnegan as extraordinarily complex, caught between the conflicting forces of the police, the editors, the paper's owners, and the black community. Finnegan reported on the South African press for the New Yorker magazine, where he's a staff writer. He expanded the story into the new book Dateline Soweto. Finnegan told me why he wanted to travel with black reporters in South Africa.
Well, I had spent some time in South Africa before. I'd worked for a year teaching in a black high school in Cape Town and written a book about that experience, and then went around speaking to groups in the U.S. about South Africa and was struck by how many people had been surprised to read my description of the opposition press in South Africa. Americans, some, seemed surprised to hear that there is an opposition press in South Africa. People seemed particularly intrigued by stories I told about a friend who is a black reporter in Cape Town. And so when I wanted to go back to South Africa and was looking for a specific story to tell, it was an obvious choice, particularly black reporters on a white liberal paper, I thought, besides having a ringside view of what's going on in the country, really catch it from all sides, from their editors and indirectly the owners of the papers, from the police, of course, and from the black communities they work in.
Well, it's very hard for a white reporter to travel with a black reporter into the black areas, but it was especially hard because when you were there was a state of emergency declared. Did that make it exceptionally difficult for you to get to where you wanted to go?
It did make my job a little harder. It really changed the job of really all reporters in South Africa, but particularly the black reporters. The staple of their work, which would be, you know, political marches, political meetings, political funerals, strikes, boycotts, and so on, that was just cleared away. And
this is stuff you were no longer allowed to cover.
Well, the things themselves stopped happening.
Mm-hmm.
Mid-June 1986. I mean, those, you know, political meetings, political funerals, those are the places where very often the security forces and activists, what were being called comrades, often clashed. I mean, so the sort of violent headline events all stopped dead, really, in mid-June 1986. I had been running around with these guys for several weeks when that happened, and I saw their jobs just really change. We kept going out, but it did get harder. I mean, a lot of the townships in the Bantustans were sealed off to all non-residents, much less whites, much less white foreigners like me.
Even without emergency regulations, whites never cover black territories and never travel with black reporters. Why is that?
It's probably not true to make such an absolute statement, but it is true that it's very difficult for white reporters to cover the townships, I mean, and the war zone, the black townships and the Bantustans, the rural black areas, because, well, several reasons. I mean, for a start, there are very few, if any, white reporters who speak the six or seven languages that are essential for getting around in those places. They don't know the territories themselves, and there aren't many street names or house numbers to help you. They don't know black society, black politics. You know, it's quite complex, and there aren't a lot of roadmaps available to that either. And finally, it's quite dangerous, at least while I was doing the reporting for this story, in 1986. The moving in the township, for a white in the townships, it was really not possible to work much. The people's first assumption about any stranger, particularly a white stranger, would be that he worked for the system, as they say, you know, that is the police. And a black and a white traveling in a car together, well, that's the immediate assumption that would be the police. And so,
is that because that's how police travel, black and white?
Often they do, yes.
Mm-hmm. You were also afraid to carry maps.
Yeah, on occasion, I wanted to bring a map to figure out where I was, and the reporters I was traveling with would say, no, that'll just give us away.
Why would that give you away?
I think that happened particularly in a Bantustan called Kwan Dabele, where the entire area, which was it's actually supposedly a country. It's a very small, impoverished, and sort of non-viable country, but it's a big area. And it had been completely sealed off, and basically it's 500,000 residents have been placed under house arrest. But we'd gone out there to try and find out what was happening. There was a lot of fighting going on. So we had a couple of different cover stories we were going to try out on any troops or police that stopped us. Something I was going to be an anthropologist, and the other reporters were going to be my assistants, that kind of thing. And I guess the reporters I was with just reckoned that a map would give us away, that we weren't really what we said we were.
Did you ever need to use the cover story?
No, fortunately that day we never got stopped.
Mm-hmm. My guest is William Finnegan, who writes for The New Yorker magazine, and his new book, Dateline Soweto, is about his travels with black South African reporters. Now, black reporters aren't always trusted by black South Africans from the way you describe it. Why is there so much suspicion that blacks might have of black reporters?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's specifically suspicion of black reporters. I think you can speak of a sort of widespread disenchantment with the press. There have been incidents where the police disguise themselves as reporters, as TV crews, what have you, so as to infiltrate political meetings and move around in the townships. I think that the feeling about the mainstream press has got steadily worse, though, in the townships for several years, that is the mainstream South African press, that it's really failed to convey what's going on in the townships. The black reporters I was traveling with, most of them work for a paper called the Johannesburg Star, which is the largest daily paper in the country, a big white liberal daily. And that sector of the press, which is really the dominant sector, the white liberal English language press, has particularly, I think, let down people in its coverage of the conflict. And the black reporters had trouble with the stories they were bringing out of the townships. They had trouble often convincing their editors, white editors, that the stories were true and to run the stories.
I got the impression from your book that some of the black journalists are forced to decide whether they want to be journalists first or activists first, and it's a difficult decision.
Yeah, there's a lot of tension over that distinction. I mean, there's obviously a distinction that needs to be made. But the sort of thing that editors will say when rejecting stories, you know, you're not objective enough, that kind of thing, is really problematic, to say the least, in a situation like that. I mean, what the black reporters will say is, well, objectivity is, you know, reality as the editors see it, and very little more. They'll also say things like, no, we're not political activists in what we write, but then, of course, white journalists can vote, and we can't vote. Most of the journalists I was with were really pretty clear about the idea that in their situation, really the only journalism worth doing is a sort of crusading journalism, you know, that will advance the freedom struggle.
One of the reporters you were traveling with suggested that you all try to commit as much to memory as possible. Is that because if if your notebook is found, your sources could be tracked down and harassed.
Yes, that was often a consideration. Also, in some situations that you just don't want, like not having a map on, you just don't want to have notes. Some of these guys used to, besides trying to commit as much as they could to memory, would end up sort of scribbling on odd pieces of paper and stuffing these little scraps of paper in their socks. Or there's one guy, John Quilani, whom I travel with quite a lot. He used to take the cigarettes and the foil out of the cigarette box he carried and write his notes on the inside of the box and then stuff the cigarettes and the foil back in, that kind of thing. Another consideration, though, I mean, a couple of times I asked people, why aren't you taking notes? And they said, well, you know, we want to be able to get out of here and not have our notes seized. Also, I had reporters tell me, well, this is all very interesting, but the editor, the sort of thing these people are saying, the editors won't accept. They'll say, this is too hot, this is too heavy, you know, this is inflammatory. They really don't want to know, the reporters would say, what people are saying in the townships.
The black reporters were able to get stories, and traveling with them, you were able to get stories that a lot of the other press didn't have access to. One of the stories that you were there to cover is the story of Quandabele, which is a self-governing black state, a Bantustan. And the South African government wanted to give them independence, and Quandabele didn't want independence. That's a little bit hard, I think, for people outside of South Africa to understand. Maybe you can explain that a little bit based on what you learned covering the story.
Well, the sort of grand plan for the denationalization of black South Africans was, and I mean in some quarters still is, that is some quarters in Pretoria, to create these 10 separate sort of tribal states to which all black South Africans would be assigned, you know, according to where they were born or what language their father spoke or what have you. Often these were places that the people involved had never seen. And they were carved out of the poorest rural areas in South Africa and altogether comprised 13% of the land. And, you know, 72% of the people were to be assigned citizenship in these various areas, thereby losing their South African citizenship and thereby finishing the argument, it was hoped, in Pretoria about black political rights in South Africa because there wouldn't be any black South Africans. Now, this was the grand plan developed in the 50s and the 60s. And four or five of those Bantustans, as they came to be called, sometimes now called homelands, have taken independence and are these ostensibly independent states. You know, there's quite a political struggle in these places over this issue, people not wanting to lose their South African citizenship and participate in this blatantly fraudulent scheme. But Quandabele, the most recent one, the most recent Bantustan to be confronted with this choice, has balked, I think, successfully. I mean, I think you won't see another Bantustan take independence. I hope I'm not wrong. But there was a lot of fighting going on in Quandabele. I mean, there's a small clique of politicians and businessmen and their hirelings who stand to profit from independence, I mean, who are going to be given monopolies in various areas. And that group was willing to accept independence, but there was a huge movement of students, workers, civil servants, teachers against independence. And so there was a lot of fighting out there on the subject and over the issue. And we went out there to try and see some of it.
I think one of the issues that you came to understand a little bit better because of traveling with black reporters through black townships was why there is black-on-black violence in parts of South Africa.
Sure. I mean, in a place like Quandabele, I mean, just about everybody fighting is black. Well, I shouldn't say that. There were white soldiers, both working as advisors to some of the black forces and involved in the fighting. And there were some black police commanders also, white police commanders also involved. But South Africa is a fairly complex society, I mean, a fairly diverse society at this point. There is this huge fundamental conflict between settlers and indigenous people. But enough of the conflict is spun off into different sectors, and And frankly, whites have the means to have a lot of other people doing the physical fighting for them. I mean, they can pay people drawn from the huge pool of marginalized proletariat, so to speak, in South Africa. I mean, people who don't have anything and for a little money will do most anything. And so you end up with police-backed vigilantes, different sort of groups, very, very locally oriented, who are battling other local groups over resources. That's a sort of primary strategy of apartheid, I guess you could say.
Well, the impression I got was that sometimes the South African government will invest power in a group of blacks who are clearly thugs, and people will fight them for that power because they rule very unfairly.
Right. It's the basic divide and rule approach to administration, where you have very scant resources, you know, of land or water or business licenses or what have you, just very scant resources. You put a small, ruthless clique in charge of those resources and let everyone else exhaust themselves trying to wrest that control away. And in fact, the sort of tribal conflict that the South African government is very fond of using, this idea anyway, as a reason why majority rule can't work in South Africa, that is, all the so-called tribes in the country will fall out among each other, is the evidence for that kind of scenario is often drawn from small-scale ethnic conflicts you see in small areas in South Africa that, in fact, if you look closely at them, you will find have been very much created from above. That is, people have been divided along ethnic lines or pseudo-ethnic lines. One group's been given access to this land or whatever, or these jobs, and the group next to it is forced to oppose that group to get anything for itself. And so you have this sort of imposition from above of a structure that ends up looking like ethnic conflict from below, but is in fact not.
I want to talk with you more about the press in South Africa, but first we're going to take a short break. William Finnegan is my guest. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, and he's written two books about his experiences in South Africa. His latest, Dateline Soweto, tells of his travels through the black townships with a group of black South African reporters under a highly restrictive press ban. His earlier book, Crossing the Line, chronicles his experiences as a teacher in Cape Town in 1980. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
William Finnegan is my guest, and we're talking about the South African press. You were just talking about some of the stories that black South African journalists can get in South Africa. Once they get back with a story that has a different perspective than, say, any of the white journalists have put on it, how likely are they to see that story printed in full and given good coverage in a white-run liberal South African paper? Well, like the Johannesburg Star, which is the paper that the reporters who you worked with write for.
Yeah. Well, at the Star, there were about 50 reporters while I was around. Six or seven of them were black, and the blacks were very much assigned to the townships. That was their beat. But the paper actually put out separate editions for blacks and whites. The black edition was called the Africa edition. And, I mean, it was this sort of same paper with a number of stories transposed, you know, stories that were assumed to be of interest to black readers, substituting for stories assumed to be mainly of interest to white readers, you know, according to which edition was going out. And a lot of times, what seemed like a big story would only get, you know, brought out of the townships, would only get played in the Africa edition, which had a much smaller press run.
You say that in South Africa it's frequently easier to print opinion than it is to print fact. I guess you could be more outspoken in a column than you can in a repertorial piece where you're actually naming names and talking about how many people were detained or imprisoned?
Yeah. I think in a way that's always true. But it's particularly true under the South African censorship laws, where you are much freer to express opinion than you are to report facts. The ordinary censorship laws, that is, the censorship laws under normal conditions, are quite extensive. There are over 100 laws restricting what you can print. You can't write anything about the activity of the South African military or what goes on inside the prisons, and there are all these areas that you can't cover at all. In fact, a few years ago, one of the major papers started running a picture of a little pair of scissors alongside each part of a story that had been changed or cut to follow the censorship laws, and it was quite startling, the effect. I mean, there were little scissors all over every page of the paper. And that's all, remember, self-censorship. That's being done by the reporters themselves or by the editors or by the lawyers. And this is all under normal conditions. And since mid-1986, there's been a national state of emergency, in effect, that introduces a whole other range of restrictions on reporting. So all that goes into any consideration about what can be printed as well.
What has the reaction been of the white liberal editors in the opposition papers to the press restrictions that have been in effect since the state of emergency?
Well, it's pretty strong. I mean, they have always been, that is, the editors of the big white papers, quite eloquent in their denunciations of apartheid and in their calls, at least in recent years, for immediate negotiations between the government and the leaders of the black majority. They're also quite good on detention without trial, which is a massive phenomenon in South Africa, unfortunately, and quite good on press freedom. But as for actually defying the laws, taking chances, being hauled into court, that's very, very expensive. And I think that a fair amount of the criticism leveled at them for not taking more chances. This is sort of, a consensus black opinion about the mainstream press. I think that's justified.
One of the reporters that you traveled with complained that black reporters are always expected to write, in times of crisis, stories that are headlined, "Black Leaders Appeal for Calm." And he didn't want to do that. Is that typical? I mean, is that literally true, that the black reporters are expected to write those stories?
Well, that was just a particular instance that I witnessed when the state of emergency came down and thousands of people were disappearing into the jail, into the jails on the day. I was there in the little section of the newsroom where the black reporters worked, which they called the ghetto, when a call came from the editors saying, "We want a story, Black Leaders Appeal for Calm." Sort of a journalistic chestnut in a situation like that. And the reporter I was sitting with, John Quilani, who was the one they wanted to write it, just said, "No, you know, how can they expect us to write that kind of thing when we're under this kind of attack?" And he didn't.
The reporters who you knew are now restricted from covering a lot of stories. Have they come up with ways of getting around that, with circumventing any of the restrictions?
Well, they do. They're supposed to continue filing stories and leaving the question of whether or not the stories can run up to the editors and the paper's lawyers. I think that they must, a lot of their story itself has dried up. That is, the contacts that they use to find out what is happening in the townships, many of them have been arrested, and many of them are still in jail, and many more have been driven underground. Plus, there's much less going on above ground, so there's less stories to report. And I think that in news, sort of timing is everything. And when you know that a story, even though it's good, is not going to run, at least not run right away, until the lawyers have gone through it with a fine-tooth comb, I think that's got to affect your sort of zest for the job.
Do you think that the press ban in South Africa is accomplishing what the white government wants it to accomplish?
I think that internationally, yes. It's been quite a success. That is, it used to be that you could find out more about what was happening in South Africa at some levels and in some areas by reading the international press than you could by reading the South African press. For instance, when South Africa invaded Angola in 1975, you could read all about it for months in the international press, while most South Africans had no idea that their army had even gone into Angola. There are many, many examples of that kind of thing. But with the new press restrictions over the past couple of years, the foreign press is virtually as shackled as the national press. And that has really affected coverage, of course, but as for whether people could get more out than they do, I'm not sure. I think it's more a question of perspective. I mean, definitely the foreign news organizations in South Africa decline to risk their presence in the country over one story. And that's cumulative. I mean, you get more and more stories shelved because they seem to get close to the regulations or transgress them. But even more, it's just this problem of perspective. I mean, reporting in a way that will convey the black perspective, if one can speak of a black perspective in a country where there are 25 million black people, on events, you know, where you just do the reporting basically in the townships and in the Bantustans, trying to look at the issues of the day from that angle, that's what the government really doesn't want, and that's what they really crack down on. And that's not anywhere in the laws, but you can see journalists, foreign reporters who are kicked out, and the only sin you can find is that they really did that kind of digging and produced a story that emphasized black experience somehow. That's what's really suffered, because that kind of reporting has gotten harder and harder to do.
You've gone to South Africa twice, once to teach and once to follow black journalists on their stories. What's the experience like for you being white in South Africa? I would think that there's this constant desire to want to explain yourself, to want to separate yourself from the whites who support white rule, to constantly declare where you stand.
It's funny. That really hasn't been very true for me. I think that the fact that I was not South African really helped when I was teaching in a black high school in Cape Town. I had much less suspicion to overcome. Being American, people gave me more benefit of the doubt, I think. That is, my colleagues and my students in the community. But it's surprising how little, actually, I felt that on this more recent trip, spending time with the black reporters, the fact that I lived in South Africa before was actually very helpful. That is, I think probably my questions were a little less stupid than they might have been, a little less elementary, and more than that, they could just make certain assumptions about what I knew, and also the general assumption that I wouldn't be running around with them if I wasn't sympathetic somehow to what it is they're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. William Finnegan, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
William Finnegan's new book is titled Dateline Soweto, Travels with Black South African Reporters. He's also the author of Crossing the Line, A Year in the Land of Apartheid. Both are published by Harper & Row. Finnegan is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with British journalist, poet, and critic James Fenton. He was one of the last reporters in Saigon before the fall, and he later lived in a monastery in war-ravaged Cambodia, where the monks were certain that he was a CIA agent. His new book, All the Wrong Places, is a collection of his reporting from countries on the brink of civil convulsion. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As a founding member of The Byrds and Crosby, Stills, and Nash, David Crosby was one of rock's biggest names in the late 60s and early 70s. But his longtime addictions to cocaine and heroin left him ill, paranoid, barely functional, and nearly dead. He kicked while in prison on drug charges, and now he's beginning his comeback. Coming up, the first of a two-part interview with David Crosby. Also, rock historian Ed Ward concludes a two-part profile of the Five Royales, a group that pioneered the soul sound. And book critic John Leonard reviews Alfred Kazin's survey of the role of nature in American classics, from Poe and Melville to Faulkner. It's titled A Writer's America, Landscape in Literature. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Dale Willman. Michael Dukakis today sought the support of traditional California Democrats. His campaign stops in the San Francisco area coincided with the release today of a Los Angeles Times poll that showed the Massachusetts governor 11 points behind George Bush in California. Dukakis hopes to take his message directly to the people tonight during a scheduled interview on ABC's Nightline program. Meanwhile, George Bush today stayed out of the battle between the two campaigns over who is lying, while in Ohio, Bush instead spoke out about economic issues. NPR's Jim Angle reports.
The vice president left the unseemly task of arguing over which campaign he is lying to his surrogates today. Though he continued his direct criticisms of Dukakis in a speech in Columbus, he said he was trying to do it in a nice, kind, and gentle way. Without mentioning the accusations from the Dukakis camp about racist campaign tactics by the Republicans, Bush offered his own accusation as he talked about what he called Dukakis' irrational economic policies.
I spoke of irrationality, and I must say that I have been disturbed as I've witnessed my opponent's campaign over the several past weeks at the increasing appeals to class conflict.
Bush was referring to one of the central themes of the Dukakis campaign, that George Bush is trying to protect the interests of the wealthy, while Michael Dukakis stands for the working man. Bush said there is no place in American public life for philosophies that divide Americans one from another and that excite conflict among them. I'm Jim Angle with the Bush campaign in Lima, Ohio.
With the stroke of a pen, President Reagan today promoted the Veterans Administration to the cabinet-level Department of Veterans Affairs. The legislation signed today creates one of the largest cabinet agencies with 240,000 employees and an annual budget of $30 billion. At today's signing ceremony, President Reagan paid tribute to those who have defended the nation.
This bill gives those who have borne America's battles, who've defended the borders of freedom, who've protected our nation's security in war and in peace. It gives them what they've deserved for so long, a seat at the table in our national affairs.
The new Cabinet of Veterans Affairs will officially become part of the cabinet on March 15th. South African police today clashed with students protesting segregated elections scheduled for tomorrow. Police used tear gas, rubber bullets, and clubs to scatter demonstrators, calling on black voters to boycott the elections. Archbishop Desmond Tutu today appealed to all sides to avoid violence and called for an election day fast. Earlier today, a bomb exploded southwest of Johannesburg, injuring a policeman and extensively damaging a shopping center. It was the second bombing in as many days. A car bombing near Johannesburg yesterday killed two people and injured 42 others. Police said the attacks are part of a campaign by the outlawed African National Congress to disrupt tomorrow's elections. West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, on the second day of a four-day visit to Moscow, met with Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev today. Earlier, Kohl laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier beside the Kremlin Wall, paying homage to German and Soviet soldiers killed during World War II. Kohl also met with dissident physicist Andrei Sakharov. Kohl is seeking Soviet backing for changing the status of Berlin and improving relations between West and East Germany. But Gorbachev appears to have ruled out any change in the German division that followed the Nazi defeat in World War II. The accused killer of 6-year-old Lisa Steinberg went on trial today in New York. Former criminal lawyer Joel Steinberg is charged with second-degree murder in the battering death last year of his illegally adopted daughter. The trial judge today decided to permit Steinberg's live-in lover, Hedda Nussbaum, to testify during the trial. During opening arguments today, Steinberg's attorney described his client as eccentric. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In the 1950s, a singing group known as the Five Royales was reshaping rhythm and blues into soul. Their musicality and style inspired many acts. Their finesse also impressed our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward.
Last week, I started a two-part piece on my favorite group of the 50s, the Five Royales. I explained how they'd started in Winston-Salem as a gospel group called the Royal Sons and had gone to New York when they got a contract with Apollo Records, the same outfit that recorded Mahalia Jackson. After several top hits there, the Royals' mentor, Carl LeBeau, left in 1953 to join King Records in Cincinnati, and in the summer of 1954, the group followed his lead and signed with King. Greatness was right around the corner for the Five Royals, but it was a long block until they reached it.
Right around the corner, that's where my baby stays. And I can get to my honey's house 15 different ways.
The group was still remembered by the rhythm and blues audience for its earlier hits. And although they put out 12 singles on King between 1954 and 1957, none of them were hits. Instead, the group supported itself by touring, its stage routines getting wilder and wilder. They ran across the stage, jumping into each other's arms. Loman Pauling, their amazing guitar player and main songwriter, was the first guitarist to wear his instrument slung low over his hips, and he could play it behind his back while he did a split. Ask any old-timer from a vocal group, and he'll tell you they were the group to beat, and nobody did. Finally, in 1957, one of their smoldering ballads with Johnny Tanner's unbelievable voice broke through the bottom of the charts.
Tears of joy.
More musically sophisticated than most of the vocal group material at that time, Tears of Joy is one of the masterpieces of the genre. It also inspired Loman Pauling to come up with their biggest hit yet, one which features his guitar just a little bit. Now, nobody was playing guitar like that in 1957, I guarantee you. And among the people around King Records who held Loman Pauling's talent in awe was a young singer named James Brown, who'd modeled his famous Flames around the Five Royales and had a hit with Think in 1960. Loman was on a roll, and the group's next record is the one most associated with them, but I bet you've never heard the original.
This is dedicated to the one I love.
Next words are, Life can never be exactly like we want it to be, and that's sure true here. Dedicated to the One I Love was a stone flop, and in fact, the Five Royales were never to hit the charts again, although that one song has been a hit several times for others. I discovered them in about 1975, a year after Loman Pauling died in Winston-Salem, when I bought the Dedicated to You album. What appealed to me, besides the tight harmonies and amazing guitar work, was Loman Pauling's songwriting, which could be tender, non-sexist, and capable of expressing a lot in simple, direct language.
Say it.
Come on.
Today, the Five Royales are properly regarded as one of the first soul groups, and if their records were available anywhere in the world, no doubt Loman's songwriting genius would be recognized for what it is. Until then, though, to Johnny Tanner down there in Winston-Salem, and any others of you who might still be around, guys, this is Dedicated to You.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone history of rock and roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
Come on, baby.
This is Fresh Air. Long Time Gone is one of the records that made Crosby, Stills, and Nash one of rock's most popular groups of the late 60s and early 70s. It's also the title of David Crosby's new autobiography. Crosby was a founding member of the Byrds, and later with Stephen Stills and Graham Nash formed Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Frankly, many of Crosby's friends and fans thought he'd be dead by now. His longtime addiction to heroin and cocaine left him paranoid, dissipated, and nearly non-functional, and resulted in one of the most public declines in rock history. Crosby was busted on drug and weapons charges and spent 11 months of 1985 and 86 in prison, where he was forced to go cold turkey. Crosby says he's now drug-free, he's making a comeback, and has a forthcoming solo album, as well as an album with Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. I asked him if writing his autobiography was a cathartic experience.
Unquestionably. You got to understand that I did lots of things that I am very unhappy about. But you can't just let them sit there in your head. They'll sort of fester on you, and you, at the same time, can't dwell on them. And writing all of this down and going through the process of having to, sift through it and find what was significant and what wasn't, and then put it in some communicable form, was actually a great help to me in dealing with, everything that I've been through.
Let's talk a little bit about your music. Your father was a cinematographer. you went to prep school, and shortly after you got out of prep school, you went right to Greenwich Village and started performing there. In the folk and the rock music scenes, where did you see yourself fitting in?
I didn't. It wasn't as if I planned any of it. I had always thought that I would want to, you know, go into films because, as you say, my father was a cinematographer, made films, and I thought, you know, that was a pretty glamorous, you know, attractive thing to do. But I just wound up with a guitar in my hand singing, and that was it. As soon as I did it, I said, yeah, this is what I'm supposed to do.
Would you describe that first night that you sat in uninvited with Roger McGuinn and Gene Clark right before you together formed the Byrds?
Oh, gee. If only my memory were that clear. I can give you a generic version. We were all three hanging around the Troubadour in Los Angeles, which at the time was the folk club in Los Angeles. And, you know, we had all obviously heard the Beatles records, and we were all trying to do that. And Gene was able to write, you know, sort of Beatlesque sort of changes, and Roger could play them. And the effect of Roger playing them in his sort of folky style on a 12-string, an acoustic 12-string, at that time we didn't have any electric instruments, was startling. And I have been in singing harmony since I was about 6 years old and just jumped on it like white on rice and instantly loved it. And they loved it. And the rest was history, as they say.
Kind of asked to leave the Byrds.
I was thrown out.
You were thrown out. What was that about? What did McGuinn tell you? What did Roger McGuinn tell you when he asked you to leave?
Well, Roger and Christopher, who, by the way, now are both very good friends of mine, at that time were very frustrated with me being, you know, such an egotist and a pushy guy. And I was very frustrated. I felt I was being held back. I was blossoming as a writer, and I felt, you know, that I had been locked into a role of being the guy who played rhythm guitar and sang harmony. I thought I was better than that, and I wanted more of my tunes on the records, and yada, yada, yada. You know, it was all, you know, kind of just growing pains mixed with some ego and stuff.
Shortly after getting thrown out of the Byrds, you formed another band, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, with Stephen Stills, who had been with the Buffalo Springfield, and Graham Nash, who had been with the Hollies. Did you take a different approach to harmony than you did with the Byrds?
I did once Graham showed up, I'll tell you that.
How is it different?
Well, that's three-part.
Uh-huh.
It's a whole other ballgame.
So what kind of place did you have to find for your voice?
Well, I wound up having to sing what I am proud to say is probably the most difficult part, the middle part, which has to accommodate the other two parts. If we did anything really that I'm proud of in terms of singing harmony, though, it was that we managed to be pretty inventive about it. And I think that's one of the reasons that we, you know, achieved the kind of strange sound that we did.
Getting to the point where I'm no fun anymore.
I am sorry.
Sometimes it hurts so badly I must cry out loud.
I am lonely.
I am yours. You are mine. You are what you are.
Give back it
hard. Remember what we've said.
Well, you were singing songs that were very popular among hippies who were doing a lot of marijuana and LSD and celebrating psychedelic drugs. You were already onto much harder drugs. You were doing cocaine. You got involved in heroin. You started freebasing early on when freebasing was invented, so to speak.
Yeah, probably more earlier than most people. It was mid-70s, I would say, I started really doing that. When I started out, though, I started out doing the same thing everybody else did, which was smoking joints and psychedelics. And you get to understand, at the beginning, that was a very innocuous thing. You know, it seemed perfectly all right to do. And if you were around, you would remember that when cocaine first came on the scene, everybody told you that wasn't addictive either. Well, turns out that's not the case. And then, of course, when I graduated to freebasing, which is much worse than snorting cocaine, ladies and gentlemen, it got much worse.
Well, you took a lot of risks, not only with your health, but with where you were freebasing. You started freebasing in your car while driving.
Yes, I did.
Freebasing in commercial airliners.
I did that too.
Keeping the stuff underneath some kind of poncho or something so no one could see. It's amazing that you didn't get killed or busted long before drugs.
Oh, there were much worse ways of getting killed. I did almost die from heroin overdoses. One of the things that happens to you that I don't know if you do know about is that when you do enough cocaine, you get to the point where you have seizures from toxic saturation. I had them, I had one driving a car down the freeway. I took out 100 yards of crash fencing. I could have killed other people. I came so close to death a number of times that I am amazed that I'm alive.
Well, after you started having seizures, your friends realized that you were really near death and that if they didn't take some kind of action, that you'd be gone. And a lot of your friends gathered to try to convince you to go into rehabilitation. Who were some of the people who were there?
It's called an intervention.
Right, okay.
And it's a known tool of, you know, drug rehabilitation. And in my case, it didn't work.
Why didn't it work?
Well, you know, that's what they said. But they really don't understand that when you get past a certain point, that the drugs have their own power. You know, I can remember saying, I'm not going to do this. And I'd look down and there would be the torch and the pipe in my hands and I'd be doing it.
Tomorrow, David Crosby talks about kicking his drug habit during his year-long imprisonment. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Jerry. How are
you? What stories do you have planned?
Well, we have reports from both the presidential campaigns and also correspondent Ted Clark reports on the Middle East and what the two candidates say, mostly about the Arab-Israeli dispute. The answer is they mostly say exactly the same thing. There are some differences, but on most major points, they're in total agreement. We also hear from David Ignatius of the Washington Post about the foreign policy debate that is not taking place in this presidential election campaign and the one that he says should take place in light of so many things that are changing. Also, animal rights in Sweden and the criminal prosecution and capital punishment of animals in medieval Europe.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A Writer's America is a new book of criticism by Alfred Kazin that explores the relationship between some of our country's great writers and the landscapes that inspired them. Thoreau and Walden Pond, Willa Cather and Nebraska and the Southwest, Faulkner and Mississippi. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Alfred Kazin's A Writer's America, nicely illustrated by the likes of Audubon and Remington, Thomas Benton and Walker Evans, is a coffee table dream book, a marvelous meditation on the way we have imagined ourselves in the great spaces of our nation, the primeval garden now despoiled. Kazin's great gift as a critic is that he carries all of our literature around in his head. He wears it like a second skin. Through him, it speaks in tongues. There's something shamanistic about his experience of Melville, Whitman, and Faulkner, of the competing Gothic imaginations of the Nathaniels, Hawthorne, and West, of the separate solitudes and desolations of a Willa Cather and a Hart Crane. In On Native Ground, Bright Book of Life, and An American Procession, these and many other writers, prophetic and profane, talk to us through Kazin as if they possessed him. It's not just his genius for quotation. Like Isaiah Berlin in his famous essays on Tolstoy and Herzen, Kazin seems to transform himself into whomever he quotes, to take on in his own prose the urgencies and ambitions, the rhythm section and the shock effects of the masters. Inhabiting the mind of Henry James, for example, Kazin is Baroque. Inside Stephen Crane, he is short, bitter, and ironic. In the company of Emily Dickinson, he's haunted by God. This isn't to say that he can't speak in his own voice. He has done so remarkably in his three autobiographies, starting out in the 30s, A Walker in the City, and New York Jew. It's just that he doesn't compete with the writers he reviews. Like a radio telescope, he pulls down their gravity from the distant stars. In fact, my only real gripe about A Writer's America is that he doesn't use himself enough, especially on cities. He's fine when he lets other writers think about mountains, prairies, and oceans, about our literary ideas of nature and the frontier as teacher and enchantment and deliverance, as epic poem and absolute freedom and substitute religion, as peaceable kingdom or vacancy and destructiveness. But when he turns to the man-made landscapes of our imperial cities, he'd be more compelling if only he quoted himself. He's as good as or better than anybody else who's ever written of New York City. I also wish he'd spent more time down south and looked at the American Southwest through the eyes of, say, Tony Hillerman, and gone on the road with some of the beats. But these are quibbles. There's more than enough room in Kazin's eclecticism for California and Chicago, for Frederick Law Olmsted and Henry George, for Teddy Roosevelt and Lewis and Clark. He gets just one thing wrong. It wasn't the wife in Robert Frost's The Death of the Hired Man who agreed that, quote, home is the place where, when you have to go there, they have to take you in. On the contrary, the wife in that poem had another notion of home. Quote, I should have called it something you somehow hadn't to deserve. As Frost himself has pointed out, this is the difference between Republicans and Democrats. Anyway, Alfred Kazin is at home and generously invites us in.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, and as a columnist for New York Newsday, he reviewed A Writer's America by Alfred Kazin. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, part two of my interview with David Crosby. In part one, he spoke about his early music career and the evolution of his near-fatal drug addiction. Tomorrow, David Crosby describes his year-long imprisonment during which he kicked his habit. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Igor Stravinsky's theater piece, Histoire du Soldat, The Soldier's Tale. The cast includes the actors Vanessa Redgrave and Ian McKellen, and the rock star Sting. And critic Stuart Klawans reviews Curriculum Vitae. It's a collection of poems by Detroit lawyer Lawrence Joseph. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Fred Landerl, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.